send them this away. Do I have them all? Oh, I'll come around there. Okay, so the what I would call the second part of the question, the time of day, nothing has changed on that one at all. So let's do that one first. So the starting point is to figure out where the sun is on February 21. And we know that on March 21, it's right here at zero. And so this is 1 month before that. So 2 hours per month, talking about a right ascension that is 22 hours. And we know we have to go from the present location at noon of the meridian to where the meridian will be sometime later that will include that star. And kind of doesn't matter how we go, but I hope you can see that this way, if we go forward in time, it's actually the long way. So there's no reason we can't go backwards. I mean, if this is where the meridian is at noon, then this is where it is at 11, 10, 9, 8, etc. So let's do it the reverse way. You have to get the same answer no matter how you do it. So here we are at noon with a right ascension that is 22 hours. So that means at 11 a.m., it's going to be 21 hours. At 10 a.m., it's going to be 20 hours. At 9 a.m., it's going to be 19 hours. At 8 a.m., it's going to be 18 hours. At 7 a.m., it's going to be 17 hours. At 6 a.m., it's going to be 6. At 5, it's going to be 15. And at 4, we'll have gone too far. So we want to get 1440, and you can see that that's going to happen at 4:40 a.m. Okay, questions on that part? So the other one, try and make them a little bit different every time, is a little bit tricky because we're in the southern hemisphere. But it basically works the same way, except for us, the north celestial pole is above the horizon because we're at a northern latitude. As we go towards the equator, the celestial pole gets closer and closer to the horizon. At the equator, the north celestial pole would be at the horizon. If we continue south, the south celestial pole is going to pop up above the southern horizon. So if we draw the usual meridian, so here's zenith, here's south, here's north. Here we are. We're at a negative latitude, so the north celestial pole is down here. But that means the south celestial pole is going to be this same 44 degrees above the southern horizon. The celestial equator goes the other way between east and west, so it has to cross the meridian at some point. And the celestial equator misses zenith by our latitude. So here it is at 44 degrees. This star is way close to the south celestial pole. So we have to go a full 60 degrees towards the south celestial pole before we see Alpha Centauri. And what we want is the angle above the nearest horizon, which is the southern horizon. And the idea is once you've, if you draw that picture, I'll give you lots of partial credit. If you draw that picture, you should be pretty close to finding the solution. And kind of what I see in this particular problem, there are lots of ways of doing it, is I can get that angle because I went 44 and came back 60. So this angle has to be 60 degrees less 44, or 16 degrees. And I know that this is a right angle. Right angle is 90 degrees. So the angle we want has to be 90 degrees less 16 degrees, or 74 degrees. Okay. Everyone get it this time? You say yes, but you can't speak for everyone. I hope so. Hope everyone gets it right on the exam. I pretty much guarantee that that'll be one of the 10-point questions on the exam. Questions about it?
Since we're in the southern half, is it just a positive 74 degrees?
So by definition, the altitude always has to be between 0 and 90 degrees. So we would say the altitude is 74 degrees above the southern horizon. If we were in Christchurch, we would turn south and we'd look up pretty high up there to see it. So I will take off points if you have altitudes that are more than 90 degrees, which would require you to bend over backwards in order to go up that high. More questions? So I remind you that there are online tutorials kind of on the screencast that go over lots of examples, including one very similar to this one, maybe even identical to this one, where we're dealing with the southern horizon. So we've got an exam at the end of the week, and the home labs are due soon. What I didn't get a chance to say last time is that I'll extend the deadline if we get a couple of days when you could actually do it. And we did have one day that you can do it, so I'm looking for one more day that's reasonably clear that you could do home lab too. Did any of you get it done on Sunday? Yeah, a couple of you. So a few of you. So we're looking for a last clear day. Needs to be clear for 4 hours in order for you to do that, and obviously at night. So we're looking for basically for a day that's clear from sunset to midnight. I'm not sure I would say blue. It's this guy here.
Okay.
So there's one thing that's maybe kind of funny, and that is that we're talking home lab 2. What happened to home lab 1? And I don't know, maybe I should change the order of them. My idea is that home lab 1 is easier to do, and you could have started at any old time. Home lab 2, you need to be able to recognize the circumpolar constellations and draw them. Home lab 2 also requires more time. So we're trying to watch how stars change over as much of a year as we can, whereas for the moon's motion, home lab 1, we just need a month of time. So the last possible start date for the moon lab is 2 March, whereas the supposedly last possible start day for the polar motion lab is 7 February. But we'll extend that until we get at least one clear day when you could have started it. Obviously, you could have started it lots of times since the start of class, but we know how that works. Best way to study for the exam is to actually do the old exams, and you can check your answers online. There's a screencast. You can bring it into my office and talk about it. Those are all, I think, good ways to proceed. You guys scheduled a session where we could get together and ask questions Wednesday here at 7:15 p.m. I've talked lots of times about a vocab quiz from that, I think it was the second day of class. I handed out this sheet of words. So we'll have a matching quiz on this on Wednesday. So you don't have to be able to spontaneously come up with those definitions, but you have to recognize the right definition when you see it. You should have a sheet like this for homework. And we're not quite up to this, but let me comment that what we plan to do is to plot the location of the planets and the time it takes to go around. So here we have kind of a normal scale. Pluto takes something like 250 years to go around, and Mercury takes a fraction of a year to go around. So we have a range of possible periods and a range of possible positions. The data for most of these things, for eight of these guys, is on page A1 in your book. But Pluto, you'll have to look up yourself. The book no longer cares about Pluto, but I do. So I want you to plot Pluto on this. So nine planets on this side. If you look at the other side, it's kind of funny. It's got a scale that goes 1, 10, 100 as opposed to 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. And how these sorts of scales work, which are usually called logarithmic scales, if you count carefully, you'll see that there are eight tick marks between, for example, 10 and 100. So this one is 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, and then we're at 100. So here we are, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And you can kind of see how this should work. This is what the plot should look like. Nine planets on this side, nine planets on the other side, total of 18 points worth of problems. Okay. Notice that all these planets are squished down, whereas here they're more spread out. Okay? Data in the back of the book, plot up those planets. Well, when I put a bunch of names like this on the overhead, the question I'm usually asked is, well, what of these names do I have to know to look to survive the exam? And the answer is here. So we're going to talk about all of these characters, and for sure you want to be able to put them in some sort of context. That's why I've given you this sort of timeline, so you can connect up. Take your favorite discipline. You know, if you're an English major, you can see what was going on at maybe a slightly different time than you were talking about. So you need to be able to put these guys into some sort of context. But I'll only ask you about this much shorter list. But you all should know the names Plato and Aristotle from any sort of liberal arts education. I think I probably first heard about him in high school. The idea of these very early Greek philosophers was that the earth is subject to decay. So things change on earth, people live and die. That's because they're made out of crap. So people are made out of earth, air, water, and fire, which are lousy elements. And you can kind of think about the earth as being a sump. It's where all of the lousy stuff has come together. On the other hand, if we could get off this toilet, we'd reach the area of the quintessence where everything is perfect, where things move in perfect circles. The material is weightless, it's shining, it's in every sense perfect. And in that sort of point of view, we have an immediate explanation for the vast majority of what goes on in the sky, right? At night, you can see 5,000 stars, and they all make even to this day, it seems to be a perfect circle going at an exactly uniform pace. But you notice that there are seven oddball cases. And what's kind of funny is those oddball cases are also the brightest things. And kind of the argument is that, well, they're odd because they're kind of corrupted by being a little bit close to the Earth. So they don't have perfect circular motion. They have some sort of compound circular motion. And the moon is kind of the worst case. You can see that it's not exactly perfect. It's hard to see exactly what's going on there with your eye, but it's clearly not a perfect sphere. And so the moon is the closest to the Earth. It's the most that's kind of corrupted by the presence of the Earth. And we kind of distinguished last time between the inferior planets, Mercury and Venus, and the superior planets, Mars and Saturn, out. They had slightly different phenomena about how they moved. So Mercury and Venus had the phenomena of maximum elongation. They're always pretty much in the direction of the sun. Venus could get as far away as 45 degrees. Mercury could get as far away as 30 degrees. They're on one side of the sun, and then they're on the other side of the sun, and then they come back. So they alternate between being evening stars and morning stars. The superior planets move slower on the celestial sphere, and they have this kind of funny motion. All this we talked about two times ago. So here's data from Ptolemy, AD 133. This is the motion of the planet Saturn. Goes the normal way for a while, and then it goes backwards, and then it goes the normal way. And if we put this together over time, we have a series of these, and they don't have to be exact loops like that. We have a series of these periods where they go backwards. And these backwards pieces happen when the planet is in opposition, 180 degrees from the sun. Okay, so that's what we see. You really can't argue about what constellation Saturn is in today. What you can argue about is how you describe it. So if you go from the sort of where is the planet now sort of point of view, and you try for kind of the simplest possible explanation, if it seems to be going forward and sometimes backwards, this is kind of the logical thing to come up with. And this is certainly the description that the Greeks came up with. So the idea was that these wanderers, planets, which now includes the sun and the moon, had this sort of kind of funny motion. So there was, for each planet, there was a basic deferent, which was a circle. The Earth wasn't exactly at the center of the circle. It was off center, and there was this magical point called the equant, which was as far from the center as the Earth was. And what was special about the equant is that it was the spot from which the motion seemed to be uniform. So you can imagine something going at an exactly uniform pace from the equant. If we have the planet way out here, since it is at a larger radius, it's going to be moving at more miles per hour than it is when it's close to the radius. So this equant accounts for the ununiform motion, for example, of the sun, right? We know it's moving fastest about there, and it's moving slower at other times. And this loop-the-loop sort of motion is explained by an epicycle, which is carried along on the deferent. So I don't know if this seems like an overly complicated system to you or not, but it works pretty well. If you want to have kind of a 1 degree sort of match between the positions of the planets and the facts, it does it. And that was good enough for the Greeks, who are not really famous for being careful observers. So, for example, Aristotle comments that men are obviously smarter than women because they have more teeth. They have this wisdom tooth. And, you know, you kind of wonder about that. We know he was married. I mean, he could have just counted the number of teeth that his wife had and confirm that men and women pretty much have the same number of teeth. So, generally speaking, these philosophers were kind of more interested about thinking than in terms of measuring. And that was kind of how this problem got spun off originally to Eudoxus. You remember Eudoxus was a student of Plato who actually worked out the details, because even Eudoxus didn't get a lot of things right. But over time, the Greeks got better and better and better. And Hipparchos is the guy who, for example, invented the magnitude system that we're stuck with, cataloged pretty precise locations of the stars. And Ptolemy was the guy who kind of summarized all of these results in a famous book that became known as the Algamas, which is Arabic for the greatest. Okay, so this system, you know, was working fine from 100 AD when Ptolemy wrote about it to 1500 sorts of times when we're jumping kind of out of the Dark Ages. So, I mean, why bother talking about stuff that's wrong? Well, one of the things I want you to see is that, I mean, science doesn't have to be right. So, we all have to agree about the phenomena. Saturn is in this constellation or it's not in that constellation. But how we interpret that data, what sort of model we make of it, that can be different. And typically when people have a model, like this epicycle system, we use words like explain or understand what's going on. But that's maybe a little bit different from believe and whether it's true or not. So for example, people argue whether Ptolemy actually believed his model. There are odd things about his model that we figure that he would have noticed and that show that his model is basically not correct. And that is, I mean, this is the motion for Jupiter. Well, I guess Mars is here too. If you work at how this works, Mars is sometimes very, very close to the Earth and by this model, and much further away at other times. And people have argued that he would have noticed that doesn't match the change in brightness of Mars. And so that he probably didn't really believe his own model. He was just saving phenomena. He was just making a mathematical equation that allowed him to more or less accurately predict the location of Mars at any given date. We don't know what he really believed or not, but certainly lots of people actually believe this model of that explained this kind of funny motion of the planets. So we jump forward then to Copernicus. Copernicus wasn't the first guy to have this idea that the sun was the center of the solar system, right? Aristarchus had this idea early on. But there's one obvious piece of evidence which contradicts it, and that's parallax. If you move from side to side, then things that are at different distance appear to be next to different things, right? So when I'm here, this star seems to be next to Tycho. When I'm here, this star seems to be next to that thing. So as I move around, that star would seem to have various positions. And in fact, by these sorts of times, people had looked at the apparent change in the position of the moon over 12 hours when we're on one side of the Earth or the other, and they could get from this parallax the distance to the moon. But people looked hard for the similar effect with a much larger distance, right? So if Aristarchus is correct, the Earth moves huge amounts in 6 months, so things should seem to have a change in position. And no such change in position was detected. So people interpreted that as evidence that there wasn't, that the Earth wasn't in fact moving, right? No, there was no evidence that the Earth was moving, and lots of reasons not to believe it, right? So from this sort of point of view, if the Earth is moving, why doesn't it stop and slow down, right? Things usually do stop and slow down. Aristotle exactly argues that if the Earth was moving, then birds, when they left the Earth, would be left behind. So they're pretty fair reasons not to accept Hipparchus/Copernicus point of view. And in particular, there's sometimes a misnomer about Copernicus. So Copernicus' system didn't work any better than Ptolemy's did for accurately predicting, say, where Mars is going to be. And the reason is somewhat odd, and that is we have seen that this equant works really well. Turns out the equant is a great approximation for how the sun moves. But Copernicus didn't like this because it violated the ideas that things should be at the center of circles and we should have uniform circular motion. So he outlawed the equant, so he got rid of something that helped, and he still had circles within circles. So as a matter of fact, his system didn't work any better than the existing system. So, I don't know, there really wasn't any reason to believe Copernicus. Incidentally, at the same time, there are lots of kind of interesting arguments against the Ptolemaic system. So, one argument was, so there are of course biblical arguments for the idea that the Earth is stationary and that the sun is moving, but there are also biblical arguments against that, right? So if Christ literally ascended into heaven, then how did he get through all these crystalline spheres? It wasn't, and theologians actually argued about that at this time. Okay, so we came up next with Tycho Brahe. He decided to kind of resolve this situation by actual measurements. So heretofore, people who had made measurements of where Mars was in the sky hadn't gone about it with the greatest possible accuracy and with the greatest possible systematic work. So he had an island of slaves, and every day it was clear he did the best possible job of very accurately measuring the locations of these planets. So he had 20 years of data in order to, he hoped, resolve this situation, to come up with a better model. And I think we said that he had, I don't know, may seem like kind of a crazy model. So his model was still geocentric, that is to say the Earth wasn't moving. The moon moved around the Earth and the sun moved around the Earth, but everything else went around the sun. So Jupiter was moving around the sun and the sun was moving around the Earth. So I don't know whether you think that's helpful or not. It's clearly actually not going to help much. As long as you're using circles, how you connect up those circles and which object you consider at rest isn't going to change the angles at all. So in any case, he got kicked out of the island when a new king came to Denmark. And he moved on and hired Kepler to actually analyze his data. So he was a pretty old guy at this point, and he was really not much of a mathematician. Kepler was an excellent mathematician. And Tycho hired him with the proviso that Kepler try and fit Tycho's very accurate numbers to Tycho's model of how the universe worked. And typically, when scientists write up their work, they don't talk about all the false leads that they went on to. And Kepler was an exception to that. So we have all of the attempts he made for many, many years to try and make the model work. And it kept not working. It worked way better, hugely better than this. Maybe 10 times better than that. But it didn't work as good as he thought it should work. The naked eye can resolve distances that are about an arc minute in size. It's about a 30th of the size of the moon. These sorts of methods would work good if you only wanted to get, say, a third the size of the moon. You know, moon is pretty small, so you're getting pretty close at that point. But he thought you should get a whole lot closer. And what he hit upon, basically by accident, that is to say, he was trying to use these circles within circles, and it turns out that it was just complicated to do that. So he started approximating circles within circles with ellipses. So first of all, what's an ellipse? So an ellipse is something kind of like a circle, except it has kind of two centers. So you know, if you want to draw a circle, what you do is put one pin in the paper and you stretch the string as much as you can and you get the set of points that are equidistant from that point. For an ellipse, you put in two pins and now you keep the string taut as you go around in a circle. So technically speaking, an ellipse is the set of points in which the total distance from two points is a constant, namely the length of the string. So what he found is that the ellipse that he was using to approximate these circles within circles was a better match than any circle within a circle that he could come up with. So his first discovery is that the planets seem to move on ellipses. Now, technically speaking, he was only given the data for Mars. Tycho had, you know, spent his life collecting this data. He wasn't going to give the house away. So he only gave Kepler the data for Mars. Eventually, when Tycho died, Kepler got all the data and he could check the other planets. But his first evidence was just that Mars in particular was on this sort of elliptical path. Now, knowing the path is kind of only the starting point for predicting positions, because you not only need to know that the planet is going to be on this sort of path, you need to know when it's going to be on this path. How fast is it moving? And you know that sometimes things are moving fast and sometimes things are moving slow. That's how the equant was working so well. So what sort of model can we have that's going to explain the change in miles per hour that these planets are undergoing. And the idea is this really funny possibility called the law of aerial velocity. Now, so aerial is coming from area. And what he said is, if you think about how a planet moves day by day by day, it's going to be sweeping out kind of a triangle, right? So if a planet was here at midnight last night, and here's where it is midnight tonight, you can think about this as a long, skinny triangle. And you can calculate the area of that triangle. And what he said is the area that was swept out every day was the same. So what that means is that if a planet is close to the sun, the height of that triangle is going to be a lot less, so it has to have a lot bigger base. So it must be moving a lot more distance per day when it's close to the sun than when it's far from the sun. And I hope you see how crazy that idea is. So what I want to stress is that you should take that as evidence as how many other things he tried first, right? This is not the first thing you're going to try. But this is the thing that works. And in fact, this is, we'll learn exactly the correct story. So this is Kepler's second law. And if we look at the timeline, yeah, one of these ways is right. Kepler's first and second laws came at the same time when he just had the data for Mars, and then a noticeable time later he came up with his third law. And it's kind of important to keep these things separate. So the second law is talking about how planets move at different miles per hour in their orbits. If this is an elliptical orbit, here's say where the sun is, the planet is going to be moving more miles per hour here than it's moving there. And in doing that, it's going to be sweeping out the same amount of area per day. Kepler's third law deals with different planets. It's going to sound pretty similar. And what this law says is that the planets that are further out are going to be moving slower. How slower are they? Well, it turns out there's a precise relationship between how long it takes them to complete an orbit and how far they are on average from the sun. And if we measure the period, that's how long it takes to go around in years, and we measure the distance they are from the sun by what's called the astronomical unit. So it's a big number in order to deal with the solar system. The astronomical unit is the distance the Earth is from the sun on average. So we take that distance from the sun, in astronomical units, and we take it to the 3/2 power, and we get the period that it takes for a planet to go around the sun. Okay, so Pluto is way far out, about 40 AU out, and it takes hundreds of years for it to go around. Mercury is close in, I don't know, 0.2, something like that, 0.3 AU, and it takes it just 88 days to go around the sun. Okay, so these, and I hate to use this word true, these rules are all great rules, highly accurate rules, rules that we teach today, but they're funny. So, you know, you can kind of argue for circles based on perfection, but what do ellipses have going for them? And this aerial velocity, you're never going to convince Aristotle that that is any sign of perfection. The relationship between the periods and the size of the orbits, it's nice. You might say that it makes some sense just if you're Aristotelian, but if you're Aristotelian, you really have no idea how far those planets are out. Let's go back and talk a little bit about ellipses. So with an ellipse, we've got these two magic points, which are called foci. And the sun is at one focus, and there's nothing special at the other focus. You notice that we've got a big diameter and a small diameter. So the big diameter, that's called the major axis. And what you might call a radius, which would be half of that, that's called the semi-major axis. Kind of like radius. So it's a distance from the center at which there's nothing special to either side of this this orbit. And it's usually denoted by the letter A. And of course, we've got a minor axis. And so we've got a semi-minor axis. And that's usually denoted by B. So major axis, minor axis, those are kind of extensive variables, right? More is more. We also want to have a variable that is intensive that talks about the shape. Because ellipses, if you think about it, if you move these two focuses very close together, you're going to get something that very closely approximates a circle. And if you get them very far apart, this ellipse is going to be very, very, very flat. So this thing that measures shape, it's called eccentricity. So to make an intensive variable, we want to have a ratio of two extensive variables. What we have is the ratio of the distance that the focus point is from the center divided by the semi-major axis. So you can see if you have an eccentricity of 1, then that string is going to be taut, and the ellipse is going to be totally flat. On the other hand, if the focal point is at the center, then we're going to have a circle. So things that are in between are going to be in between. So, I don't know, so here are some examples of real ellipses. Drawn by a computer. So this thing has an eccentricity of about 0.8. So here would be the sun, and here would be the motion of that object, which is a particular comet. Probably the most famous comet is Halley's Comet. And you can see it has an eccentricity, 0.97, that is very, very close to 1, and it's pretty flat. Yep, question?
I guess you just don't understand how a comet has an ellipse. Is it the path the comet travels, or is it the actual shape of the comet?
So we're not talking about the shape of the comet itself, but the orbit that it takes. Right, so here's a cometary orbit, it goes way out, comes back in. And we know from this aerial law that it's going to be moving really fast here, and it's going to be moving really slow out here. So comets spend almost all of their time moving just a few miles per hour way out in the distant cold parts of the solar system, and then we see them for a few months as they flash through the inner solar system. Questions? And what else is happening, of course, is comets are basically made out of things like ice. When they're way out here, that ice is going to be in solid form. When they get close to the sun, we're going to have evaporation. So then the comet will evaporate a lot of stuff off of it and will have a tail, as opposed to just an ice rock when it's out there. More questions? So those orbits are usually pretty big. So what do the orbits of planets actually look like? So it that way? Yeah. So this is the data that Kepler had to deal with. This is the orbit of the planet Mars. Boy, it sure looks like a circle that's off-center. And remember that an off-center circle is exactly what the equant was. So that's why the equant works so well, is that the orbits of planets are very, very close to being circles with off-center points. Here's what the most eccentric planet looks like. This is Pluto. It's a dwarf planet these days. Still very much looks like a circle with an off-center point. Okay, so that's why the equant system works so well. Here's an actual circle, and you can see if I put it in here, the minor axis really is a little bit different from the major axis. But it's pretty hard to tell. It really took these extremely and this is Pluto, the most one. Here's really what we had to deal with, Mars. Very closely approximates a circle that is simply off-center. I'm not even sure you can see the difference on the board. So it really took extremely accurate measurements from Tycho in order to detect this very small difference between the equant and the actual value. And of course, that's what kind of screwed up Copernicus. He threw out the equant for philosophical reasons, and then he kind of messed up his whole system as a result. Okay, so eccentricity, semi-major axis, semi-minor axis. Remember that the sun is at one focus, there's nothing in particular at the other focus. Because of the aerial law, the planets are moving really fast when they're close to the sun, and they're moving really slow when they're far from the sun, exactly like what the equant would have predicted. Okay. Yep.
Are the major and minor axes of the different planets' ellipses lined up, or are they off from one another?
So first of all, they're so circular. If I were to show you, and maybe I will later, a map, the only one that looks funny is Mercury. Everything looks to your eye just like a circle, but in fact, there's no relationship to the elongationness of these various orbits. And in fact, what happens slowly is that the actual pointiness of these spots changes in position. So you might guess, of course, that I think I've said before that this special time when the Earth is close to the sun and when it's moving unusually fast, it's currently in January, that time is actually slowly changing as the spot where we're closest to the sun changes. So that in the future that orbit might look like that. So this is called the precession of these orbits. More questions? And for the comets, it's totally random. So the planets are all pretty much in the same plane, and the comets come in from all possible directions. Okay, so by looking at the data, Kepler came up with these rules for how the solar system worked. And it turns out that another guy, in some sense a more famous guy, had a lot of these same ideas and proof that would convince a non-mathematician. So in order to follow Kepler's work, you have to go through all of these detailed calculations based on Kepler's very accurate, you know, six-digit precision locations. And I don't know, you either kind of have to accept that Kepler did the arithmetic right or not. So Galileo is going to come up with faster, quicker proofs of the same sort of point of view. But incidentally, Galileo is actually wrong on lots of regards. He was still a believer in the circular sort of ideas. He never really went over to this elliptical idea that is, in fact, the correct idea. So the key point that's going to allow Galileo to do so much important work so quickly and fundamentally with a whole lot less effort than Kepler and Tycho put into it is this fact: the telescope's invented. Not by Galileo, we're not entirely sure exactly who did it. Looks like it came from the Netherlands, and Galileo kind of heard about it, and he took it to the town council and claimed that he invented it and sold it to them at a high price. But importantly for us is that he was the first guy to use a telescope to look at the sky. And as soon as you look at the sky with a telescope, which of course Tycho Brahe never could do, all sorts of things become a whole lot clearer, no pun intended. So the first thing that comes as a pretty obvious proof of the version of the solar system that Copernicus put forward has to do with the phases of Venus. So let's try and find the bad system. Maybe the bad system is totally covered at this point. Ah, here we go. So here's what Ptolemy would have said. People thought that Venus was in front of the sun. It could have been behind the sun, but if it's going out in this sort of circle, it's always going to be in front of the sun. So there could be new Venuses here, and there could be new Venuses there, and we could have crescent Venuses over here and crescent Venuses over there, but we would never have a full Venus. Right? In order to have a full Venus, we'd need to have Venus over there, and it never got very far from the sun. So when you actually look through a telescope, though, what you see as you go through this cycle is when Venus emerges from behind the sun as an evening star, you see it as a gibbous phase. Then as time goes on, we see a half phase. Incidentally, Venus is currently about there, not quite half. Then it'll be a crescent phase, and then it disappears into the glare of the sun, and then we see it as a morning star, as a little crescent, and then it gets big as gibbous, and then it goes behind the sun, and we can't see it anymore, and it emerges as a gibbous object. So the only way Venus could be both basically full and new when it's in the same direction as the sun is if it's actually going around the sun. And that was not the point of view of Ptolemy. So that's one point in favor of Galileo. Another important observation, another kind of criticism that people had of the Copernican model is it's a little bit unsymmetrical. So everything goes around the sun except the moon. And again, Aristotelians would argue that how could the moon keep up with a moving Earth? It would get left behind. And what Galileo did is he looked at Jupiter. And he said, I don't know how those moons keep up with Jupiter, but there are four of them, and they're going around Jupiter just fine. So there doesn't seem to be anything particular special about the moon, about the Earth being able to hold on to a moon. Jupiter can hold on to four of them. The other swipe that Galileo had against Aristotle was this idea of perfection. So the sun had been taken as, you know, an example of a perfectly symmetric object. But if you looked at it through a telescope, you could see that the sun was spotted. It had black dots on them. And if you could follow those black dots, you know, they'd come out of one limb and go out the other. It wasn't a perfect object. The moon doesn't look all that perfect to your eye, but if you look at it through a telescope, you can see that there are mountains and valleys and flat spots. Seems to be a spot very much like Earth. It doesn't seem to be made of this quintessence. Looks pretty rocky. And finally, we have the idea of zillions of stars. So we have this 5,000 that sort of number of stars that you can easily see with your naked eye. For presumably for millennia, people have noticed this band of whiteness in the sky that we call the Milky Way, right? Because it's a little bit milky. And by using a telescope, what he could figure out is that the Milky Way was actually made out of zillions of very close together stars. So the universe didn't seem to be designed in the way Aristotle claimed, and for sure Venus went around the sun, and for sure it doesn't seem to be a problem for planets to have moons. And so he published all of these observations as evidence that the Earth seems to be in motion. And as you know, famously, he got in trouble with the church for this possibility. I'm looking for my timeline. He actually did all of this really quickly, and we have pretty good evidence that he actually saw a new planet too, but didn't understand what he was looking at. He saw Uranus. Where is my timeline? Oh well.
Is it next to the computer?
Ah, it has to be where I'm not looking, right? But I don't see it there either. Oh, no, that's not it. Warmer, colder, down here. Oh, this is not for any particular purpose. So you can see, so here's where the telescope was invented, and really in just a year he had published these findings. He got in trouble with the Inquisition. Here's where he's imprisoned, and you know, kind of, so imprisoned is maybe an overstatement. Put under house arrest. At this point, the Inquisition kind of put dampers on astronomy and general scientific progress in Europe. And what we're going to switch to is the outskirts of Europe, England, and to a guy named Isaac Newton. So you may know that here we had the start of the Protestant Revolution. England at this time is not a Catholic country, and so it was a relatively safe place to have unusual ideas. And we have this interesting time mark, the Black Plague in London. So Newton at this time was a student at Cambridge. School was called off because the bodies were piling up in the street. And so he went home and he thought about what could be causing all of this stuff, how the universe could in fact be working. And often these stories that you hear about Washington and the cherry tree, etc., are apocryphal. But we actually have a letter from Newton that describes kind of how he got started. And supposedly, he was looking at the moon, full moon, and a tree, apple tree. And what happened was the apple took that moment to fall. And he asked himself the question, why is it that the apple falls and the moon doesn't? And behind that question is the idea that whatever is causing the apple to fall is the same thing that's causing the moon to go around in a circle. So starting with this basis, he came up with three laws of motion that describe how everything works. And although we wouldn't say these laws are exactly true today, they're a very excellent model for how the universe works, and they're certainly still taught in every university in the world. So Newton's laws of motion. Now the main point here is that Newton is going to have the point of view that the heavens and the earth are subject to exactly the same rules. The heavens are not made of the quintessence. They're not going to be any different from anything else. And so we should be able to figure out, if we figure out how apples work here on Earth, we should be able to explain how Kepler's laws work. These funny rules about aerial velocity and ellipses should fall out of a proper consideration of how matter works here on Earth and every place else. And the laws seem pretty innocuous. The first one is that if an object is subject to no forces, the result is it goes forever in a straight line. At a constant speed. Incidentally, we have Aristotle's work in where he considers this possibility, and he says it's absurd. It's impossible for something to go forever in a straight line, basically because he thought that the universe was finite, and straight line motion would not be an option. And one of the things that's funny about this Newton's first law is you never see anything like this. You have never seen anything go in a straight line at a constant speed forever. So this is a law that's not based exactly on phenomena. So I can show you examples where we have today can make this credible, but particularly if you're thinking about these times, pre-1700, you know, if the horse stops pulling the cart stops. And that was exactly the sort of thing that Aristotle believed. Things had a proper place on Earth, and you could force them to move, but if you turned off the force, they would stop moving. The reason things fell is because they wanted to get to their proper place, namely, as close to the sucky spot that is the Earth. Okay, so kind of a funny law that's not based on anything that you can ever see, or certainly that Newton never saw, the claim that if there are no forces, then we're going to get straight line motion forever. Well, what if there are forces? So if forces are present, then obviously we're going to get a change in velocity. Right, because no forces, the sign of it is a constant velocity. And you can calculate the change in velocity. So usually people use deltas to indicate change. So the change in velocity can be calculated by the force divided by the mass times the time that that force was applied. Now, usually people talk about the change in velocity per second. So if we take the time and divide it on this side, we get the change in velocity per time. That's called the acceleration. So another way of talking about Newton's law is that the acceleration is the force divided by the mass. And then people often put the mass also on that other side of the equation, and then they write F equals ma, kind of like E equals mc squared. So Newton's third law is, I think in some sense, a funny law, in that it is just like his first law deals with situations that he could never observe, his third law deals with all imaginable situations, even things that hadn't come into existence yet in pre-1700 England. And what he declared is that forces always come in pairs. And very commonly, his third law is abbreviated action-reaction, but don't do that on an exam. So the third law says is, if object A pushes on object B, then automatically, no matter what sort of force is used, so if some sort of special unknown mental force allows A to push on B, we are guaranteed that B pushes back equally and oppositely. So the kind of the usual example you see in high school texts is rockets that are flying, which I think is kind of a poor example. And the idea is that the rocket is pushing on the exhaust, so the exhaust has to be pushing back on the rocket. But, I mean, what I would consider a better sort of example is this extremely dull one. I'm pushing on the wall, and the wall is pushing on me equally and oppositely. This rock is pushing on this table, and the table is pushing up on the rock equally and oppositely. Well, we'll talk more about that in a second. So Newton has three laws, but I like to write down a fourth law. That's his law of gravity. So one force Newton thought he understood, namely the force of gravity, and he said there's a formula for the force of gravity. You can multiply together the mass of the Earth and the mass of the apple and divide by the distance between their centers squared, and that has to be proportional to the force. These days we add in Newton's gravitational constant. It's a number you could look up in books. To calculate exactly what that is. So if you want to calculate the force on the moon, you take the mass of the moon, you multiply it by the mass of the Earth, divide by the distance between the Earth and the moon squared, multiply it by this number g, and you get the corresponding force. So obviously we'll talk more about this next time.